On the whole, let me begin by introducing the use of the Old Testament in the New. And in that context, the basis is, first of all, as you can see up here, the primary Bible of the early church was the Septuagint. Now, the Septuagint, what LXX is simply the symbol that we have for the Septuagint in most writings, means the 70, of course, Roman numerals. The Septuagint was the Greek Old Testament. It was basically translated from the Hebrew from about 250 BC to about 100 BC. It took about 100 to 150 years to translate it. Some of you may have heard of a thing called the Letter of Aristeus, which was the famous letter that supposedly told how it was translated. But in reality, in actuality, the whole letter is a legend. Because the letter said that the librarian of Alexandria called for 72 Jewish rabbis. And they came to Alexandria and then were closeted in 36 different rooms. And after a year, they came out with 36 exact replicas of the Septuagint. Now, that would be great if it was true, you know, because 72 is the number of nations from Genesis. On the other hand, though, it simply can't be true because the Septuagint is simply too diverse. In reality, we have the same problem with the Septuagint that we have with the older New Testaments. Namely, there are six different recensions of it, three Jewish, three Christian. And so we actually have a text critical problem in trying to decide what the original Septuagint was. Plus, there are just innumerable different translators and innumerably different translation styles. There are some parts of the Septuagint, especially the Pentateuch, that are translated like the ESV, you know, a literal translation. Then there are other parts, like some portions of Isaiah actually has three different translation styles in itself. And some parts are like a living Bible, virtually, of the translation. So therefore, it was done by many, many different translators over a very long period of time. But the main thing for us isn't that. The main thing for us is that approximately 60%+ of all the Old Testament quotes in the New Testament are taken from the Septuagint. In Matthew, all of the quotes that Matthew takes from his sources, like Mark, etc., are from the Septuagint. And the ones that are actually direct translations, say by Matthew, of the Masoretic, the Hebrew, are primarily the formula quotations that we're going to be looking at in just a few minutes. So most of Matthew's are as well. And interestingly, the two most Jewish books of the New Testament, namely Hebrews and James, every single Old Testament quote is exactly from the Septuagint. So, you know, that what that tells us, as it's more and more known, is that the Septuagint was even the Bible of Palestine, let alone diaspora Judaism. And so, therefore, the reason I'm saying this is not because any of us are going to be Septuagint experts. You know, we're not, and nor can we be expected to be. But when you look at a quote in the New Testament, and then you go back to the Old Testament, you see, whoa, this is really different. The reason is it's the Septuagint rather than the Hebrew Old Testament that it's quoting. And so therefore, there are many differences between the Septuagint and the original. So you see, that helps us to understand that. You know, and that's something that we need to keep in mind as we're looking at the quotation of the Old Testament and the New. And there are even places like in Hebrews where the point is taken out of the Septuagint, not the original Hebrew. So we just need to be aware of that. The next thing has to do with, you know, the various kinds of material that the New Testament writers used. Because there are, as you can see up here, I have three different types of discussions and quotations of the Old Testament in the Targums, Midrash, and Qumran. I'll explain those just briefly, just so. And the purpose there is to give us greater understanding of what's going on. The Targums are very, very interesting. Some of you may have never heard of that, but think about it this way. In the first century, when Jesus and Paul lived, Hebrew was no longer the spoken language of the people. For over 100 years, Aramaic, in fact, really since the post-exilic time, Aramaic had replaced Hebrew as the lingua franca, the basic language of the Jewish people. And so by the time of the first century, Hebrew was like Latin in the Roman Catholic Church. It was a religious language only found in the scriptures. And so therefore, in the synagogue services, when they read from the Torah, they would be reading a language that most of the people did not really understand. So the Targums were Aramaic paraphrases, you see. They would read the Hebrew, and then they would read an Aramaic paraphrase, which became the Targums. And the value of it is, again, notice, remember the word paraphrase. That's very important, because the Targums, therefore, don't just translate, they interpret. The Targums become very important source material for how the first century Jewish people, their teachers, have interpreted the Old Testament text. So we have many, many clues, you see, to what they understood by these passages. And therefore, the Targums become extremely valuable for helping us this. And then Midrash is the term for the basic hermeneutical method of the Jewish people. Now, obviously, I need to interpret hermeneutics. That's not a term you use anywhere except in some college or seminary. Normal way I introduce that is hermeneutic is not a Czechoslovakian who owns the corner drugstore. You know, hermeneutic. Now, hermeneutic is the Greek word which means to interpret. And so hermeneutics is a technical term for how we interpret Scripture. Midrash was how the Jewish teachers interpreted the Old Testament, you see. And, of course, Midrash is the basic technique that is found in the Talmud, which was codified and written down between the 2nd and the 4th centuries, and really represents post-70 AD Judaism, after the Temple was destroyed and Judaism had reconstituted itself as a religion. But basically, though, the importance of Midrash is that we see how the Jewish people understood the Old Testament text and how they interpreted it. Now, the importance of this is one thing. When you look at how the Old Testament is used in Matthew or Paul or Peter or Revelation, we are really not supposed to go back to that through our own, you know, 21st century Old Testament scholars. That is, we are not interpreting Isaiah. I should say, Jesus is not interpreting Isaiah through Dr. Smith or John Oswalt's commentaries. Jesus interpreted Isaiah through the understanding of Isaiah in first century Judaism, didn't he? Now, Jesus was not a 21st century Old Testament scholar, so it's very important to ask, how did the Jewish people understand Isaiah or Zechariah? See, that's the key to the use of the Old Testament and the New. It's how did they use these books in Second Temple Judaism, in the time of Jesus and Paul. See, so that's what we need to do when we're studying the use of the Old Testament, is to ask that very, very serious question. Now, Qumran also then becomes important. Now, how many of you have heard of Qumran? Okay, a few of you haven't, or you're too tired to raise your hand getting ready for lunch. Basically, that was the community that developed the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course. They were the Essenes. That was the name of the Jewish sect. They were the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and the Essenes. And the Essenes were a monastic Jewish group that believed the rest of the nation was apostate, and they alone were the elect of God. And they developed, and that's what I have Pesher there right after Qumran. That was their hermeneutical technique. Pesher is a this-is-that approach. The rabbis, Midrash, basically said, this applies to. And so they then would try to take the Old Testament text and provide contemporary applications of it, like we do. But Qumran believed that they were the chosen community that fulfilled the entire Old Testament. So therefore, this is that means that they were the fulfillment of every expectation of the Old Testament. See, that's this is that. While for Midrash, this applies to that. And in reality, there are a lot of parallels between Qumran and New Testament Christianity, because obviously this is that really applies to Jesus, doesn't it? Jesus, Paul, Romans 10:5, Christ is the end of the law. What Dr. House said last night from Matthew 5:17, which we're going to talk about again yet in a little bit, as Jesus said, I've come not to destroy, but to fulfill the law. And so therefore, this is that really is Jesus is what was expected in the Old Testament hope, understanding, and prophecies. So you see, there are a lot of parallels with Qumran and that type. with the use of the Old Testament and the New. And we're going to be seeing some of that as well. Now, within that then, that's the various methods. Those three are the various methods we use. But now we want to try to get at what different kinds of fulfillment are there in the New Testament. And there are two major kinds that I want us to notice. First of all, is obviously there is direct messianic fulfillment. Now, what I mean by that is you have many passages in the Old Testament that were direct, absolute prophecies of Christ coming. And there are many of those, like Isaiah 53, Jesus as the suffering Messiah, the servant of Yahweh. And Psalm 110:1, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. Here, the author was prophesying the coming Messiah. But there are also what we call indirect prophecies, and that's where I have that last word, typology. Typology is probably the single most important term for the use of the Old Testament and the New. And we're going to see a lot of that. Most of Matthew's fulfillment passages are typological. Let me explain that. First of all, Jesus did not just fulfill the actual messianic prophecies. Jesus as Messiah fulfilled the entire history of Israel. That's what typology means. It's type, antitype. Typology deals with analogy. And think about it this. The basic term for it, I would call corporate identity. I'm sure you've probably heard of that somewhere. Corporate identity means, for instance, the king represented the nation before God. David was the nation before God. Moses, when he went on Sinai, were the people of Israel standing before God on Sinai through Moses, the representative, you see. The high priest, when he went into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement, represented the nation. He was corporately identified. In him was embodied the nation coming before Yahweh in the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. Now the Messiah would be corporately identified with the entire history of the nation. So the Messiah would relive everything Israel had experienced. And that's what typology is all about. Christ reenacting. Under it, we have all kinds of themes that we're going to be seeing in Matthew, where Jesus, in a very real sense, brought about a new exodus, a return from exile. See, in all of these themes, we're going to be seeing here in Matthew. And so with that in mind, then, let's turn to Matthew and see how that works out, you know, in the pages of this incredible gospel. And what I'm going to do is center upon the fulfillment passages. As I said, Matthew has 60 different quotes of the Old Testament, but about 11 of them are called fulfillment quotations because they have in them the words of Isaiah the prophet were fulfilled saying. And you have this formula that Matthew uses on these 11 times. And again, now, let me go a little bit deeper into the meaning of that fulfilled. The Greek word is plerao. And the word itself means to fill to the full, to fill up, to complete. Now, what Jesus meant in Matthew 5:17-20, when he said, I've not come to destroy but to fulfill, and then he said, every yod and tittle is intact in me. The word meant, first of all, that the entire Torah is complete and intact in Jesus, the Messiah. It also means that Jesus has lifted the Torah to a higher plane. He has deepened it. That's the antitheses that follow, Matthew 5:21-48. Antitheses mean that little formula that Jesus uses. You have heard it was said, and he quotes one of the Ten Commandments or a key moral passage of the Old Testament. And then he says, but I say unto you, then the I say unto you is the meaning of fulfill, you see, that in Jesus the Torah has come to completion and been deepened. And then he deepens that. You know, you've heard it was said, thou shalt not murder, but I say unto you, anger is murder in the mind. You have heard it said, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery, but I say unto you, lust is adultery in the mind. And so Christ has deepened them. And behind that is the Jewish expectation that when the Messiah came, he would bring the final Torah, the Torah of the Messiah. And really, the Sermon on the Mount is the Torah of the Messiah, the new kingdom laws and regulations that contain the Torah in its entirety and fulfill it and deepen it. See, and that's what we have in these quotations and in their purpose. So the whole point is that Christ has brought the law now to its final intention in God. Yes. Yes, and also, thank you for asking that, because now I can give you the one I meant to give you and haven't. The final aspect of that is Jesus is the final interpreter of Torah. So he has embodied it in his life, but he's also given the final meaning of it. So yeah, I'm glad you asked that, because I had meant to say that and then just started saying, well, we've got to get in Matthew. But that's what it's involved. So what I want to do now is to take these 11, and I'm going to break them into seven aspects of this, and then we're going to look at these 11 formula quotations. Now, my goal in this is not just to center upon Matthew, but to give you a feeling for how we work with the Old Testament and the New. Because there are really, let me give you this, just as we get into it, there's three stages at which we study the Old Testament and the New, whether it's Matthew or Hebrews or Revelation or Paul. In any of these, we do these, first of all, the first step is we look at the original meaning of the Old Testament passage. That is, we really study the passage in its context and then ask, what did it mean in Isaiah 7 or Jeremiah 34? You know, and in all of these, what we're asking is, you know, what did it originally mean? Second stage, now this is not something that most of us will do, but we need to be aware of it as we're using various sources. The second stage is to ask, how did the Jewish people understand and interpret that passage in the time of Jesus? Because that becomes a very important clue to how Jesus or Paul, you see, is using this material. So we want to understand how it was used in Jewish writings and how they let, you know, that's where we get the Targums and the Midrash and various Jewish writings. And that's something that probably we won't be able to do for ourselves. But if you're using a decent commentary, the commentary will do it for you. It will take you back into some of these writings. But you see, that's one of the necessary things, because we do not want to over-theologize by reading into it all of the Old Testament studies of our day, which Paul didn't have. So we want to see how they understood it then and what Paul or Jesus are doing with it, you see. And that's what we're going to be doing in Matthew. Then the third level is to then ask, how does Matthew, how is it used in Matthew? How is it used in Romans? How is it used in Hebrews, Revelation? So then we want to ask, how is the biblical writer, under the inspiration of the Spirit, developing that? And that's where we get into very often this issue of new meanings and applications. That is, as they appropriate these Old Testament texts and embed them in their own texts, very often they're taking them in new directions. And that's the key debate today. The key debate today is, did the New Testament writers care about the original meaning of the Old Testament text? Many critical scholars say that the New Testament writers didn't care, and they took the Old Testament passages and took them out of their context and read them in new ways on the basis of their own needs. That's wrong. That isn't true. It is true, though, that they were able, and Jesus did often, to interpret it in such a way, building upon its original, that there seems to sometimes be a new direction given. Let me give an example outside Matthew. Let me use Revelation 1, verse 7. Revelation 1, 7 is in the prologue, and it's one of the key passages in Revelation, and it's a quote from Zechariah 12, 10. Revelation 1, 7 really begins with Isaiah 7, 13, where it says, behold, he will come on the clouds. And then the rest of it, after that one line from Daniel 7, comes Zechariah 12, 10, so they will look upon the one they have pierced, and they will mourn. Now, in Zechariah, first of all, it's the tribes of Israel will look upon the one they have pierced and mourn for their sins. In Zechariah, it's revival of the nation. It's mourning for their sin and getting right with God. In Revelation 1:7, it's taken in another direction because instead of tribes of Israel, it's the tribes of the earth. It's the nations. And then mourning in Revelation 1:7 is primarily mourning for the judgments that are going to come down upon them. And so then many say, John, in writing that, didn't care about the meaning in Zechariah, but only put, you know, and changed its meaning entirely in that new context of Revelation. But I think, as I look at it, that actually in that there's a deliberate double meaning, and there's a kind of, we might say, a reverberation, in which Revelation 1:7 is the key to the two paths the nations will take in the rest of the book. And so mourning has double meaning there. It's original Zechariah. Portions of the nations will repent and come to Christ. And we see the nations in chapter 5 and chapter 7 and chapter 15 and chapter 21. You know, the nations bring their glory and they stand before the Lord from all the nations. But then there's a second path, you see, that is in keeping with use of it, mourning for the judgment that will come upon them. A portion of the nations, most of them in fact, will reject the Messiah, turn to the beast, and experience the judgments of God. And so in reality, and we're going to see this in Matthew as well, that the texts are being used in keeping with their original context, but still deepened, just like Jesus does, Christ, the final interpreter, and Matthew, building upon that, is taking them in a sense, dynamic directions, but it's in keeping with what they originally meant. Any questions about that before we go into the examples from the formula quotations? Okay, let's start them, and let me give you them in order then. The first that I want us to look at, the first theme is Jesus reliving the Exodus and the exile, both going in and returning. And here we have two of the really famous quotes in chapter 2. Because we have, first of all, Hosea 11:1 here in chapter 2. And then we have Jeremiah 31, verse 15. Let's take them in opposite order. Let's begin with chapter 2, verses 17 and 18. Now, the reason for that is I'm going to take them in terms of its original rather than in terms of its use in Matthew. Because I want to follow the exile, okay? Chapter 2, verses 17 and 18, is where Jesus and his family have returned from Egypt. And as you can see in the text, then we see Herod, who's filled with anger, and he then has the slaughter of the innocent. And involved in that then, in verse 17, you know, the whole idea is that what Herod has done, it says, then the word spoken by the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled when it said, and notice again, it was fulfilled. And what did it say? Then we have that quote from Jeremiah 31:15. A voice heard in Ramah, weeping, deep mourning, Rachel weeping for children, refusing to be comforted, for they were no more. Now involved in that is a prophecy in Jeremiah of Israel going into the exile. Now in Jeremiah, this passage is not messianic. There is no hint of the Messiah whatsoever there. See, Jesus is reliving the exile. Jesus is fulfilling that. But what's interesting is that both in this one and the one in verse 15, when they come out of the exile, both of them are seen as further fulfillments. In other words, there's a double typology going on here. In Jeremiah 31:15 and then in Isaiah 11:1, Hosea 11:1, you have the prophecy of Israel going into the exile, Jeremiah, and then coming out of the exile, Hosea 11. But in both passages, Rachel weeping for children, that's going into the exile, they were reliving the Exodus. Coming out of the exile, they were reliving the Exodus. Here, and it's being used of Jesus, Jesus has a double fulfillment here. He's reliving the Exodus and the exile. See, so there's a two-stage in salvation history, a two-stage fulfillment. The Exodus relived in the exile. both of them relived in Jesus. And so you see, Jesus is corporately identified, is absolutely reliving what the people of God have gone through in the whole history of the nation. So he is the embodiment, you see, of the people of Israel. Many have written on this as a theme in Matthew. And the theme is called Jesus, the New Israel. When we think of the church as New Israel or True Israel, actually the church is New Israel because it's the people, the community of Jesus. And so we're New Israel because we're one with Jesus, who himself embodies Israel, you see. Now think how much theology there is in this. Just think how deep the meaning of this. You know, you could meditate upon this for the next year easily. And there are major books being written on this. If this, in fact, is kind, you might even say the new fad. I think it is a new understanding. But there have been books coming out over the last few years. There's a book written by a guy by the name of David Powell on the New Exodus theme in Acts. And then later there came another one written by Ricky Watts, a scholar who teaches at Region in Vancouver. And that's the new Exodus in Mark. Now, I have a student right now at Trinity who's going to be doing the New Exodus in Matthew. See, this is going to be developing. There's going to be a New Exodus, and there's still going to be one in John, and there's definitely going to be one on Paul, because the New Exodus theme is maybe at its highest in Paul. But see, this is a motif that really begins right in these passages. Christ has relived the Exodus. In him is the New Exodus. And if any of you have ever read, have you heard the name of N.T. Wright? He's become a major New Testament scholar. And his whole thesis is that Jesus is really, his whole message and his whole life is a return from exile. In Jesus, the people of God are now going to return from exile. Now, Wright way overstated that theme, but there's still truth in it. It's still a major theme. It's not as central as Wright makes it, but it's still a... See, now think about that in terms of us. What these passages are saying is that for us, Jesus has brought about a whole new return from exile and a new exodus. And they're intertwined. They're one and the same motif. He has brought us back. And that's the whole meaning of his death. That's the whole meaning of his life. And so it begins at the start. When he goes into Egypt and comes back, these things have been relived. In Hosea 11:1, out of Egypt I've called my son. See, again, in Hosea, that return from exile was the new exodus. And it was conscious. Out of Egypt I've called my son. I mean, as I did in Egypt and in the wilderness. Now, in the midst of the exile, I'm in process of calling them back. And I will call them out of this new Egypt, namely the exile in Babylon. And I'll bring them back to the promised land. Back to what in Hebrews is called the rest of God. See, all that is there. And it's just, you know, such major, major, deep and really exciting teaching. Well, let's move on because of time. Wow. See, we're supposed to be done at 12, aren't we? Isn't that okay? Good. I just got to keep watching the clock. I've only done one of them so far. The second one, Jesus fulfills the Isaianic longing for salvation and healing. You know, and this is seen in Jesus' messianic ministry. With this in mind, you know, what I want us to look at is, in a very real sense, all of these fulfillment passages. And here, let's turn to chapter 8, verse 17. And just some interesting material involved in this. Because what's going on is, it says, this is in the midst of Jesus' healing ministry. Matthew 8 and 9 is where Matthew is coalesced into a narrative, Christ's healing ministry, his miraculous ministry. And here in verse 17, he's interpreting that. And he says, well, it was spoken that Isaiah prophet was fulfilled. And then it has from Isaiah 53, verse 4, he took on himself our weaknesses and bore our diseases. Now, in this, again, Matthew is closer to the Hebrew than to the Septuagint. This, in all these passages, again, Matthew is drawing upon, he's directly translating the Hebrew Old Testament for us. But the main thing here, of course, is a question of what it means to taking our weaknesses and healing our diseases. And there's some debate between literal and spiritual. You know, and this is, does it talk about Jesus miraculous healing ministry, or is it talking about sin? And here again, as in so many, there's a double meaning going on here, isn't there? Both in Isaiah and here, because in Isaiah 2, it's physical and spiritual. And by its being placed in Matthew 8, definitely, the point of it is that Matthew is saying that in Jesus' healing ministry, he was bringing salvation to the people. And Matthew, more than any other gospel, has an emphasis upon faith in the healing ministries. Now, it's not prosperity gospel. It's not that Jesus only healed people on the basis of how much faith they had. You know, that's a heresy, the prosperity gospel. This is not that. What it is saying, though, is that the faith of the individual allowed them to move from physical to spiritual healing. The way I like to put it, because the verbs are used, through the faith of the people, therapeuo became sozo. Those of you who know Greek. What that means is, therapeuo, you know, therapeutic means healing. Sozo, salvation, means saving. So, and the verb is used. And I think it's used in Matthew with exactly that meaning. That is, physical healing becomes spiritual healing as Christ touches them not only physically but spiritually. See, and that's where Matthew has this major faith theme going on. And that's what this passage is all about. Jesus, in his healing ministry, brought the salvation of God as, again, Isaiah 53 here, deliberately used by Matthew, deliberately, to really say that in his healing ministry, Jesus, the Eved Yahweh, the servant of Yahweh, was present, and the physical healing turned to spiritual healing. Therapeuo became sozo. See, and there's just a great deal of meaning and power and, you know, in that very set of themes that is going on here. And so involved in that, then let's turn to chapter 12, verses 17 to 21, which is the next passage on this basic theme. In 12, 17 to 21, what we have is the second passage from Isaiah, but now in chapter 12, it's in a context of rejection. Matthew 11 and 12 is the second major narrative, story part after the discourses, you know, in between the discourses. And it's in Matthew 11 and 12 that we see the people turning against Jesus. And so involved in that, here in verses 17 to 21, we have, you basically have two opposition passages, then a discipleship passage. And you know, this is the second of the three. And involved in it, we have Jesus as God's chosen servant. And you can see here that he says, you know, again, Christ is healing in the midst of opposition. And then it says, this fulfills what was spoken through the prophet Isaiah. And so we have, again, you see that promise. And now in this context, you have Isaiah 42, 1-4. This is one of the long quotations in Matthew. But it's here in this context, because it's really meant to say the person who's doing this healing and the person against whom the Jewish people are turning is actually God's chosen servant. Now, Isaiah 42 was the beginning of the servant songs of Isaiah. Really, it's interesting, these two in chapter 8 and chapter 12, we have the beginning, the end and the beginning of the servant songs. The servant songs are Isaiah 42 to 54. And so the first of them is the one quoted here. The last of them is the one quoted in chapter 8, Isaiah 53. In this case, though, this is the one, Isaiah 53, the Jews never understood messianically. They always thought of the servant of Isaiah 53 as being the nation. Interestingly, Isaiah 42 was fairly universally considered to be messianic by the Jewish people, you know, in the first century. And so here we have, behold, look, my servant whom I've chosen, my beloved in whom I delight. And obviously, this is quoted both at the baptism and the transfiguration, you know, as we know. But involved in it in this context, you see, it fulfills it because the very one who's healing in the midst of rejection is one whom God has chosen and delighted in to be the one who will bring his power to this world and the one who will be rejected by this world as he brings his power. So Christ is, again, the suffering servant. Can you have in the next part of it, you know, I placed my servant on him. He will proclaim just the nation. He'll neither quarrel nor cry out. No one will hear his voice. See, now we're getting into the rejection theme in the midst of it. So the whole point is, at one and the same time, Jesus fulfills, really, what we all are, isn't it? Because we are his community. We are the chosen ones. We are the elect. And we are chosen to take his voice to the world, and in the midst of that, to be the broken reed. We will be rejected. We will be hated. But at the same time, then notice, the Gentiles will put their hope in his name. So you see, Christ is the one fulfilling all the hopes of Isaiah. And really, in this passage, more than any of the others, the basic message of Isaiah is now fulfilled in Jesus. The one who will bring the universal gospel, who will bring all the nations together, who will fulfill the Abrahamic promise. And Isaiah is so interesting because Isaiah is the one Old Testament author that truly understood that central part of the Abrahamic covenant, that God has chosen Israel to bring his blessing to the nations. Israel had forgotten and rejected that. Isaiah is the one book and the only prophet who recognized that the true messianic hope is a hope for the nations, not just for the nation. And so therefore, this long quote is there mainly because in the midst of it, in his healing, Jesus has brought the glory and the love and the compassion of God. But as the servant, he will now go forth through rejection to the nations. So that the Gentiles, and probably every one of us here, anyone here of Jewish background? Okay, every single one of us sitting here has to love this passage. Because that's us. We are here because in him the Gentiles will put their hope. And so we especially rejoice in this part, that the suffering servant came to include us. And that's our major message. That we are part of that, and we have our hope in him. But again, though, you see, our hope comes through rejection. See, and so, in a very real sense, you know, as Jesus said, those who want to come after me must, again, deny self, take up their cross, and follow. In other words, we must, of course, reject self, but we also must recognize that the centrality of that is we have to bear the cross of Christ. We go out with a message that will not make us popular. We go out with a message so that we should expect a certain amount of rejection from a world that doesn't want. I think of John 3:19-21, which may be the single greatest passage on this. Where as the light of Christ goes out to a world that doesn't want it. And the world hates the light, John 3:19-20. And therefore they reject the light. See, and that's what we have here. And Jesus is the one who has brought that about, who has introduced it and made it possible. Let's go on to the next theme, obviously. Christ fulfills then, also at the same time, the flip side of this, the promises of judgment on those who reject, and then of God's mysteries for those who are open. So there's a kind of a double fulfillment here of God's true intention. Namely, that those who reject that message will face the judgment of God. And then secondly, see, what I'm doing is trying to work at the themes in these formula quotations to show you, you know, all this kind of stuff. So let's look at those. The first one, in terms of judgment and rejection, we go to chapter 13, verses 14 and 15. And involved in chapter 13, 14, and 15 is this next aspect of the prophecy of Isaiah. Now, these are in the This is in the parable discourse, the next discourse in Matthew. And in the parable discourse, we have this very strange statement about why Jesus gives parables. And it just blows our minds. Because we think of parables in terms of Jesus, the greatest Christian educator who ever lived, who developed this whole brand new story form to make the kingdom truth more exciting and more understandable. Then we go to Jesus, and Jesus says, I'm speaking in parables because I don't want them to understand. So think about it this way. In Jesus, parables are an anti-evangelism technique. Now, wait a minute here. We've never done that, and we're not going to use that in our Sunday school. That will never be backyard Bible studies. What in the world is Christ saying? Now, what we need to understand is Jesus is talking here only about the people who have hardened their hearts to the gospel. In Mark, this is even more clear, because in Mark chapter 3, you have the passage where the leaders have committed the unpardonable sin. And the parable of the sower is very clear. The four types of soil in the parable of the sower are the groups that Jesus administered to. You see, in the first one, the parable on the hard-packed road, the soil on the hard-packed road, that's the leaders. And that has to do, they've committed the unpardonable sin. That's what this is all about. So this is actually only speaking of those who have rejected Jesus to that ultimate point where they don't want it. And so therefore, for them, Jesus uses Isaiah 6, 9, and 10. I speak to them in parables so they won't understand. See, that's what we have, saying, with hearing you'll hear and never understand. Seeing you'll see and never perceive. Why? For the heart of this people has become calloused. They barely hear with their ears. They've closed their eyes. Then he says, I speak to them in parables lest they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, understand with their hearts, repent, and I have to heal them. So Christ is saying, for these people, I use parables because I don't want them to repent. The best way to understand that, you see, and this is the warning to people who are bored and don't care, who sit there and say, I dare you to make me interested. This is saying, you keep up with that, you're going to come to a place where God's not going to be interested in you. And then you are the saddest person in all of history. This is a call, you see. And so this is really a final judgment. Now, the key of the parables are not just cute little stories. The parables are not just nice little dynamic devices to make the meaning of scriptural truth more understandable. Actually, the parables are meant to conceive and conceal. And the parables, most of them have in it a reversal of expectation. Where the parable starts and goes along a great little story that sounds like a Charles Swindoll type of, or a Charles Stanley, great illustration. Then all of a sudden, about two-thirds of the way through, Jesus reverses everything and leaves their mouths hanging open, as the rest of it is exactly the opposite of anything they've ever experienced before in their life. Because the parables are kingdom parables. The kingdom is the absolute reverse of all earthly mores. So the parables reverse the way things are done in this world. And the purpose of parables is to challenge and deepen and, in a sense, blow the minds of the hearer. You cannot understand the parable until you've understood the true meaning of the kingdom in this world. See, that's what this is saying. That for those who do not have open ears, the parables basically confirm their rejection. And the purpose of the parable is to confirm their rejection. But for those who are open, for true seekers, their parables challenge and confuse, but get them to seek more deeply. And then for disciples, let's turn to the next passage, which is chapter 13, verse 35. And in 13:35, Christ goes on, and you can see here it said, this is the conclusion of that. So, Jesus used these parables when speaking to crowds, never spoke them without parables. This says, notice, this fulfills what God has spoken through the prophet. See? And so in this passage, what we actually have is Psalm 78, verse 2. I will speak to you in parables. I will explain things hidden since the creation of this world. Therefore, for the disciples, parables are teaching devices that force the hearer to think more deeply and to understand more deeply the reality of the kingdom. So parables are never, ever meant to be easy. They're never, ever meant to be cute little stories. They're actually meant to be challenging, deepening, and confusing until one gives their mind entirely up. But the key is the insider-outsider, which is a theme in Mark and in Matthew. The outsiders are those who don't want the truth. So with them, the parables are judgment devices, you see. But for the insiders, those who have committed and who have come into the kingdom, the parables are revealing things concealed, the hidden things. Now, involved in this is the mysteries. The word mystery is the primary, really think of them as two ways. You have mystery and you have apocalyptic. Apocalyptic means revealed, revelation. So apocalyptic is the term for God revealing his hidden truths. Now, mysteries refers to the content of the hidden truths revealed in apocalyptic. Apocalyptic, kalupto, to hide, to conceal. So apocalyptic is a term about God revealing, God uncovering these hidden truths. Then mystery is the term for the content of those truths that are uncovered. And that's what is promised here. See, through Psalm 78:2. The purpose of the parable is to unveil these hidden truths, but to unveil them only to those disciples who are willing to place themselves deeply into the reality of the kingdom. And obviously, what it really means here is the disciple is intended to study deeply. This is never, parables are not for surface Christians. Parables are not cute little things to make things easier. They actually make things harder. But involved in it and what comes out of it is these an incredible depth of these truths that are just, you know, again, the truths that blow your mind, seriously. So, you know, that's what's going on, you know, and that's the real meaning of what this is all about. Well, again, let's move on because of time's sake. Let's go to the fourth setting. The fourth of them comes in chapter 21, verses 4 and 5. And here we see Jesus fulfilling the messianic promise at the triumphal entry. And this is a separate one, but it's very, very similar. It's, you know, it's very much the same kind of unveiling of truth. But here in chapter 21, 4 and 5, we have, again, Christ is on the donkey, the foal of donkey. He says, this took place, again. So the word spoken to the prophet, this time Zechariah 9:9, might be fulfilled. Then we have, of course, say to the daughter of Zion, look, behold, your kingdom is coming to you, meek, riding on a donkey, and on a colt, the foal of a donkey. And behind it, you have a combination of Isaiah 62:11, which is the first part of this, say to the daughter of Zion. And in Isaiah 62, say to the daughter of Zion, see your Savior comes. See, that's the first part of this. Then you have Zechariah 9:9. And Zechariah 9:9 has, rejoice greatly, daughter Zion. The king is coming, riding on a donkey. Now, what Jesus is doing here is he is overcoming the messianic secret. Messianic secret is a major theme in Mark and in Matthew, where Jesus told people, don't tell people who I am. Now, he tells demons that, tells people healed that, he tells his disciples that, and the reason was that they, including the disciples, expected a conquering king, and he came to be the suffering servant. He did not want his messianic nature promulgated because it would lead to total misunderstanding, which was proven in this very scene in Luke. Because Luke tells us that they tried at this triumphal entry to take him. They did it several times to force him to become king. And what they wanted, of course, they wanted Jesus to lead the new revolution. In fact, really, Peter proved that at the arrest scene. You remember when Peter took the sword and cut off the ear of Malchus? Peter undoubtedly, you see, he thought that his sword thrust, now it was a delusion of grandeur, but he really thought it was the first sword stroke of the final battle. He thought Armageddon was there. And he really thought of himself as then unveiling, and he really expected behind his sword stroke to be the legions of angels, you see, that would then come and destroy the Romans. So I think Peter's whole use of the sword there was part of that. So Jesus said, don't tell anybody. But now with the triumphal entry, Jesus is unveiling the messianic secret. But he's doing so consciously, and Matthew's the one who brings it out. It's Matthew that has the two, the donkey and the foal, in exact fulfillment of Zechariah. And Matthew's point is that Christ is the King of Peace, not the King of War. He has come to be, and it's Matthew, and Matthew alone, that includes the meek aspect. The others don't have that, because Matthew has a major motif called the gentleness motif, the meekness motif, of Jesus, the meek, lowly lamb, the one who's come to be the servant. And so this is a major theme. But see, in it, Christ is seen as fulfilling prophecy and now beginning to unveil the true meaning of what his messianic ministry would be. That he would be the royal Messiah, but he would be the lowly king and not the conquering hero. And very important. Of course, we see the opposite in Revelation chapter 20, verses 9 to 11. Or chapter 19, 9 to 11. Where he does come on the white horse. And all of the saints on the in his army come on white horses. But this is, you know, and again, it's very, very deliberate here, you see. And so let's go to the next one. Because now then, the fifth one is Judas fulfilling the prophecy. And that's in chapter 27, 9 and 10. And what Judas is fulfilling now is the pattern of rejection seen in Jeremiah 19 and Zechariah 11. And that's what we have here, where you have in 27:9, they took 30 pieces of silver, the price of the honored one set by the people of Israel. That's Zechariah 11, 12 and 13. And, you know, gave them to the potter's field. Now behind this, this is another typological fulfillment, because neither Zechariah nor Jeremiah were thinking of the messianic coming. In fact, the Zechariah one is rather complex. Zechariah 11 centers upon the false shepherds of Israel who have misused what Zechariah calls the flock of slaughter and have afflicted the nation. And so it looks upon God's taking over and God's actions at that time. Jesus then fulfills that expectation, and obviously the false shepherds of Israel from Zechariah are now relived in the leaders of Jesus' time. And so there's a fulfillment going on there, but again, it's typology. It's Christ reliving and Israel reliving the situation at the time of Zechariah in the post-exilic time and the failure of the leaders of Israel. And then the coming one who will now bring final fulfillment in the midst of this. See, and so, again, what we have here is Jesus reliving the history of the nation and bringing them back now in the third and final return from exile and giving them an opportunity to break the fallen nation in the time of the Exodus and in the time of the exile and to now come back to God. Yeah, and that's the whole purpose. And that's what, and Matthew, in a sense, really is, I think, thinking of his own community, probably in the late 60s, early 70s, as being, in a very real sense, a third. Because you have Exodus, exile, Jesus, and now Matthew's community. And he's giving another opportunity, you see, to the Jewish people to return from exile and to come back to the Messiah and to then re-experience the blessings. Well, let me just finish this so I can finish the course and keep the faith like Paul. So let's go to the last one. And the last one is seen... I just covered up my sheet here. The last one is in chapter 1, but somehow... there we go. I turned it over. It's the basic theme of God with us. It's Christology. The one I want to end with then is how Jesus himself fulfills all the imagery of God with his people. And that's seen in chapter 1, 22 and 23, and in chapter 2, verse 23. So you have in 1, 22 and 23, the virgin birth and Emmanuel. Fulfillment of Isaiah 7, 14, in terms of not only the virgin birth, but then of they will call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. Now, the virgin birth passage is one of the interesting and difficult ones. It's become almost a key concept of how you consider prophecy. What was Isaiah prophesying in Isaiah 7:14? You know, and what was actually going on there? And was, you know, the virgin will conceive, give birth to a son, they will call him Emmanuel, namely God with us. And I think there's two things here. There's a double meaning. And virtually everyone recognizes that. Every commentary, Dr. Smith's commentary that's coming out, John Oswalt's commentary, there's a double meaning because in the context of Isaiah 7:14, there is this birth of Hezekiah as the one who will be the counter to the evil leaders of the nation at that time of Isaiah. But at the same time, though, immediately goes beyond Hezekiah, because in chapter 9 we have it moving beyond Hezekiah to the coming Messiah. And so Isaiah is thinking of a double fulfillment there in a very real sense. That for Hezekiah, it's a young woman will conceive, then the other meaning of the term, the virgin will conceive, and then we will have Wonderful Counselor, Prince of Peace. See, and so Matthew is building upon that, and then Matthew gives us a second one that wasn't Hezekiah. We'll call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. So that Jesus is the very presence of God and the very power of God, you know, at work in this world. And involved in that is one of the key motifs of the whole Gospel of Matthew. It's the theme of omnipresence. It's found in chapter 1:23, Emmanuel, God with us. Then further deepened in chapter 18, verse 18, which is in the discipline passage, where it says, where two or three are gathered together, there am I in their midst. The omnipresence of Jesus in the church. And then finally, of course, the very last clause in all of Matthew in the Great Commission, behold, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. So Matthew begins, centers in the middle, and at the end, it's on Christ's omnipresence. And it's a fulfillment. And really, Jesus, you see, is the living presence of Yahweh with the church. We have the high Christology of Matthew involved here. So all that's involved, and I know I've thrown out a lot at you. Normally, I do this lecture in about 2.5 hours, so getting it down to 1 hour is not easy. But I hope at least it's helped you to think more clearly. And more important than the content, I think, what I hope is it will all be encouraged to always look carefully at the Old Testament passages that are alluded to and to see how much they enrich the meaning of the passage in which they're found. It's in Matthew or Paul. Okay, God bless, and it's great to be with you.